Hey guys, I'm Mike. I'm an alcoholic. I have a sobriety date of June 22nd of 2017, and for that I'm very grateful. This microphone is really freaking me out. So anyway, I'm an alcoholic, and I'm a pillhead alcoholic, which means I'm a lazy alcoholic, right? Sitting around drinking is just too much work, you know? You give me pills, and it's just off to the races. I had to go to treatment twice. The first time I went to treatment, I came here in 2015. And through these past 2 years, you know, I've done a lot of backward research, you know, and I know now that I was in a relapse before I ever left this place. And it was all about, you know, I left here taking all kinds of pills, you know, the non-narcotic, but it was always had a pill for all my isms, you know, for my insomnia, for my pain, for, you know, for everything. And what this program has taught me is that ever since I came into this world, you know, I've always been thought I had to be in control of how I feel, right? And as a survival tactic, you know, I learned to manipulate my situation really early. And I was just always living under the bondage of fear, you know, and fear of not meeting an expectation, or fear of meeting that expectation, you know. And my whole life was just my whole life was predicated on that. And I never really felt like I fit in anywhere growing up. I'm from a really prehistoric part of Southeast Texas. I'm Cajun, and you know, you guys know swamp people. I don't need the subtitles. Hey, man. I'm glad you're here, Anton. You know, I don't need the subtitles. You know, I can understand them. So if you don't understand something I say, then say what? Because I don't have subtitles. But anyway, you know, I always knew something was wrong with me. I always knew I was different. I never really felt like I knew how to act. You know, I can remember being in grade school and you know, telling myself the night before, because I had a bad day, telling myself the night before, you know what, I'm going to act this way tomorrow. I'm going to act that way tomorrow, you know. And everybody else had the playbook of life. You guys have surely heard that in the rooms before. You know, and I didn't. And I want to read something. You guys don't have to read your book with me. There's some of my favorite passages in the big book. And it's my favorite chapter is Freedom from Bondage. And it explains me to the T. It says, the mental twist that led up to my drinking began many years before I ever took a drink, for I am one of those whose history proves conclusively that my drinking was a symptom of a deeper trouble. Through my efforts to get down to causes and conditions, I stand convinced that my emotional illness has been present from my earliest recollection. I never did react normally to any emotional situation. The medical profession would probably tell me that I was conditioned for alcoholism by the things that happened to me in my childhood, and I'm sure that they would be right as far as they go, but AA has taught me that I'm the result of the way I reacted to what happened to me as a child. What is much more important to me, AA has taught me that through this simple program, I may experience a change in this reaction pattern that will indeed allow me to match calamity with serenity. So people have their ideas of calamities, right? And mine, my whole life was being in limbo of that expectation. And it's a progressive disease. So as my disease would progress, the calamity would get worse and worse and worse and worse. And, you know, when I look back, my whole life, fear was my higher power. There was no way God could have been my higher power, right? I guess I was a late starter. I didn't start drinking and using until I got in college. And things progressed pretty quickly. You know, I went from alcohol to alcohol to pot to X to coke to, I mean, I've done everything but heroin to this day. And, you know, and I still didn't think anything was wrong about that. I knew I probably shouldn't be doing it. Up to that point, I think that I pretty much stayed a step ahead of my disease. And to be honest, I don't think until this bout of sobriety that I have right now, and I just got my 2-year chip in June. I've never been emotionally sober in my life. And I'll tell you what, this one day at a time of this program has just really, really, really changed my life and saved my life. And, you know, it's all the things that I learned here at Austin Recovery, because I had to come here once and be introduced to the program, because I was 41 years old and 41. See, I don't even remember. You know, they thought I was in my 50s. I mean, I was in bad shape. I was detoxing off of opioids, benzos, alcohol. I was coming out of the grip of an addiction of about a 4-year opioid addiction. And I knew nothing about addiction at that time, right? And I thought that, you know, if you just get, and I kind of remember telling my counselor, just like it was yesterday, as cloudy as everything was, it's crazy the things that I remember that stuck in my head, right? I can remember telling my counselor, you know, just get me off these pills, I'll be okay. You know, just get me out of the withdrawals, I'll be okay. I knew nothing about withdrawals except for I was getting sick. And I didn't even know that I had been dope sick for 4 years because I didn't know what dope sick was. We all have our, you know, inherent uniqueness. And what I mean by that is when I came in here in 2015, you know, I came in here, you know, I was an alcoholic because, you know, I could have a beer with a steak, set the beer down, you know, and not drink again for forever. You know, if I wanted it that way. And I barely identify as an addict. And I didn't really know what I was. You know, I came in going, you know, I'm not sticking a needle in my arm like him, or I'm not snorting shit like her, or I'm not smoking stuff like him. And you know, right then and there, I couldn't be helped. You know, I didn't fit in. And to the place where I'm supposed to fit in, which I always do now that I'm sober, I didn't feel like I fit in then either. Anton remembers. We had some good time, man. I'm so glad to see you, dude. That just makes me. Yeah. Anyway, so like I said, I knew nothing about a program, and all I thought was that I was supposed to be, that I was failing at being the Christian that I thought I was supposed to be. You know, I already put myself, already isolated myself by not saying I'm like him or her. And I thought that, you know, the first few chapters of the big book are all about convincing, right? About convincing me to accept that I have this disease and everything. And if you think you're not an alcoholic, if you think you might be, you probably are. All those things are true. I thought I was this Christian that I was failing at, and for whatever reason, I didn't have a relationship with God. So we agnostics didn't apply to me. You know, I wasn't agnostic. I wasn't atheist. And, you know, and I just, and most of it comes from where I'm from and the reward system that I was brought up on. You know, God only helps those who help themselves. And, you know, it's nothing about surrender. Surrender's cowardly. You know, surrender is never good. Surrender is weak. These people in this program, you know, they're doing this because they're too weak to live like the rest of the world. And that's why they're in this program, you know, and I couldn't be a part of that. So, you know, I knew that some things needed to change. Up to this point, I never really kept beer or alcohol at my house. I never kept beer in my fridge. If I ever did have alcohol, I mean, it was drank that event, whatever it was for. And I never really took anything every day until I started taking Xanax for insomnia in 2006. I was living in Houston, and I had a bad accident at work. I have like a clinical insomnia, or I had a clinical insomnia. I would stay awake for 10 to 12 days at a time, completely sober, chemically sober. And you know, I'd stayed up, and I passed out off and fell off a ladder at work, and really, really messed myself up and separated my shoulder. And, you know, it scared the crap out of me. So what do? I go to the doctor, and I tell the doctor, hey, you know, I'm not like normal people. I still laugh every time I say this. I'm not like normal people. You know, I work outdoors. I work in the heat. I don't come home and have a few drinks and wind down like everybody else. I can't sleep, you know? So he's put me on Xanax, and I started taking Xanax every day from that point. And, again, that was another aspect of fear, right? Fear that I'm not gonna that I'm not going to go to sleep, that I'm going to, you know, get hurt again the next day at work. And because the profession I was in, I mean, technically I could have died any day that I went to work. You know, I could have had an accident and killed myself. Could have fell off a roof, fell off a ladder, got electrocuted, just whatever. And you know, I was still in that self-will cocoon of trying to control every aspect of my life. So I had always had back trouble. I ended up having a back surgery in 2010. And up to this point, I didn't even like taking pain pills. I didn't like the way they made me feel. I hated the itching. I hated the restlessness, the irritability. I mean, I hated it all. And when I had this surgery, boy, now I had an excuse to take pain pills, you know. And my brain, when I'm going to my doctor and I'm at my pain contract, you know, they're like, hey, this guy's had surgery. He's earned the right to take pain pills. You know, that's the way my brain thought, you know. And like I said, it would probably be a lot worse if I liked the way opioids made me feel, but I never did. And I'm just so grateful for that. I'm still in this self-will cocoon. I'm a Hurricane Ike survivor, so we moved to Austin in 08 because of Hurricane Ike from Houston. And I was in such a self-control mode that I didn't even want to go tell another doctor about my insomnia, because what if they take me off Xanax? You know, I couldn't handle that, you know. And so I was still going to Houston to my doctor in Houston to get Xanax. Coming back, I was taking pain pills. I started not remembering driving home. This is about 2010, 2011, and that started freaking me out. I was like, man, I don't even remember driving home last night. And you know, just the fact of not knowing, pretty much when I would drink or take a lot of pills, I'm a blackout user, drinker. I black out very quickly. The very first time I ever drank when I was 18 years old, I blacked out. And just that, because of my nature, you know, the only way that I knew to deal with my isolation and, you know, getting made fun of and all that stuff was to just beat everybody and everything. Go buck wild, do everything to the max, you know, just be the best at everything, make better grades, make better whatever, you know. That's the only thing I knew how to do. And, you know, I went to school with the same 20 people from K to 12. It wasn't like I could go hang out with a different crowd, you know. So it was really difficult. And thank God for step 4 and 5, because it really set me free on all that. So let's see, where am I at here? I started not remembering driving home. And I'm still new at this, so just bear with me. I try not to be all over the place. So a friend of mine told me, hey, just tell the truth. And you know what? That's the best thing. So anyway, I'm just being silly. So I got a DWI in 2011. And I don't remember driving back from Houston. I remember the incident of getting the DWI, right? And I had just come back from Houston to get my Xanax filled. And at the time, I was taking Norco. I was taking Cadian. It's a controlled-release form of morphine. It's like a liquid morphine, and it's basically non-stimulant unless you mix something else with it. Like, otherwise, besides the constipation, I wouldn't have known I was taking it. Yeah. Anyway, so... Right. So I can remember the officer. One of the things that I do remember in the DWI, the officer was like, you know, he's like, I'm not even going to give you a breathalyzer. I see all your pills in the seat over there. And I was like, well, I keep my pills with me because I've got an addict at home, you know. I had the perfect excuses, right? And he just started shaking his head, and they pulled me out. And I don't remember much after that. But I got put on deferred adjudication for that DWI. It was my second. My first DWI back in 2004, it was a normal New Year's champagne DWI. But I'm just glad I never hurt anyone, you know, and I could have. So while I was on deferred adjudication, I ended up getting 3 more DWIs. They started with a breathalyzer, you know, and I was like, it's not even alcohol related. They've already got it wrong, you know. They can't. There's they can't help me. You know, my PO has my scripts, and I'm still entitled to take all these medications. And you know, with each DWI, I got more and more and more paranoid. You know, in the third one, I knew that I was probably going to spend some time in jail, and I didn't know what. My case was kind of complicated, and it would get more and more complicated as it would go. And if you guys will let me step out of this for a second, we're really supposed to stay in the solution, but hell, there was 42 years worth of problems, so I'm getting there. So anyway, so thanks, Kent. So anyway, I was at a point where I had graduated from a breathalyzer to an in-home device. And if those who don't know, a breathalyzer keeps you from driving drunk, and an in-home device keeps you from drinking, right? And so I had to blow on that three times a day, take it to work with me, take it everywhere with me. And I was on, and then I got the next DWI. They put me on colors. I don't know if you know what colors is, but my color was yellow. And it feels so good to talk about this stuff, because I can remember being here in 2015 and I didn't want to talk about it. I was scared they were going to tell me I was in the right place, right? And so, you know, it just feels so good. So I was at a point where I was trying to pee dirty at my pain contract, pee clean at my PO appointment or my colors appointment if I had to go in for colors, trying to pee clean at work because the type of work I was doing, they would always drug test you and random. And, you know, I thought, but then at my pain contract, I didn't want to test positive for the Xanax that I didn't want them to know I was taking, because I was taking Valium too. You know, because doctor, I have to sleep. I can't, if I don't sleep on my back with all these back surgeries I've had, if I can't sleep on my back, you know, I can't move the next day. So I have to have Valium too, because he didn't know I was taking Xanax. So I'm taking all this stuff, and, you know, I just thought that was normal. I thought it was just another test in this self-will. You know, God's only going to help me if I deserve it, if I'm worthy, way of life that I had learned. And like I said, where I'm from. And I was an athlete growing up, and I got into coaching for a little bit. And, you know, I also go to another place called Texas Star, and there was a guy there that was a coach in rehab for pain pills and alcohol, and you know, and it was kind of one of those aha moments, right? I got to tell him, you know, my whole life, everything, every way that I did everything was predicated on what I learned from coaches. You know, I still haven't watched Friday Night Lights and the movie because I hate to hear coaches talking. And at one of my home groups, there's a real famous coach that's in my home group, and you know, we get to talk about it a lot. And he, he's like, yeah, I totally understand. You know, that was just, you know, keep, you know, impose your will on the other guy, impose your will, keep beating your head on the brick wall till it falls down. And if you get knocked out, keep beating it some more, you know, and eventually things are going to turn around. You know, don't ask for God's help because, you know, he's going to think you're weak or whatever. And, you know, what I'm getting at is there was no way that I was going to be helped. And that's the whole point of this program, is that I utilize the help that's available, and I allow myself to be helped, you know, and that comes with acceptance. And, you know, sobriety, what I've learned is it can suck as bad as I want it to, or it can be as good as I want it to. And just about every single time, step one has saved my ass every time. You know, I'm powerless over this or that. And as soon as I'm not doing step one 100%, then, you know, I'm out of the program just like that. And then my emotional sobriety is in jeopardy, and, you know how the dominoes fall. The reason I had all these back surgeries, I had an accident in 2013. I jumped off a bridge to get a girl out of Lake Austin, and I dislocated some ribs and messed myself up. And, you know, long story short, it was just another reason to take pills, you know. And I just had another reason. I didn't have the accident because of that, but once I did, you know. I can remember being here at Austin Recovery in 2015, and one of the NA guys came in, and he was talking about how his sponsee convince himself, and do you have a knee surgery just so you could take pain pills, you know? And as soon as I heard that, man, I just closed up. You know, I didn't want to hear that, because I didn't want somebody to tell me that, you know? And I know now that, you know, I'm the only one that knows what's in my heart. And, you know, I know if that wasn't the reason, but I was still in just as much trouble as regardless of what the reason was. So, I had to get introduced to the program and try it my own way and fail. When I came here to Austin Recovery, I got to like step four. I really had a turnaround. My eyes opened up for the first time, you know, and it was actually in this room. It was Sanjeev, Mindfulness with Sanjeev, and it was on this board right here. And I don't know if you guys know who he is, but I just had one of those wow like that, and it was like everybody at the rehab could tell before I could. They were like, man, something happened to you. Something changed. Wow. I was like, yeah, man, yeah, okay. And started doing the fake it till you make it and all that stuff and checking all the boxes. And I got to step four and five, and I was like, hell, that's just confession. You know, I'm not going to tell anybody all these things about myself. I'll just go in my room and confess, you know. And I took the program back for myself at that point. And once I did that, I was already out of the program, and I was already in emotional relapse once that happened. So the next 2 years I spent, I never really went back into the grip of an addiction, thank God. But what I would do is I would have spree after spree after spree after spree. And I went through the little things of, you know, thinking I'm normal, you know, and thinking I'm normal and thinking that I could maybe have a beer now and then, maybe I could smoke a joint here and there. I don't smoke weed because I have a spiritual malady, and that's one of the beauties of this program, is that everything in my life that didn't make sense, I can blame it on that spiritual malady, you know, and I came into the world like this. You know, I was a 2-year-old with nightmares and insomnia. I never really did react to any emotional situation right. And, you know, just all these things about me, you know, I had a lot of hate for myself, right? You guys have seen the movie Liar, Liar with Jim Carrey, you know, when he takes the recess, I'm kicking my ass, do you mind? You know, that was me, you know, I was always kicking my ass. And I hated myself, you know, when my wife was pregnant with our youngest, I didn't want to touch her belly because I didn't feel him kick, because stuff like that freaked me out. I couldn't watch stuff on TV with any kind of mortality thing, you know, I couldn't do it, you know, and I knew that it was because of whatever was wrong with me that I didn't want to admit, you know, and every hardship that I ever had, you know, I never blamed it on God, because I always knew it was my fault somehow. And it's not my fault that I have a spiritual malady. It's not my fault that I have a spiritual malady and I have a disease, because I believe this goes way beyond a disease. Some people are familiar with the pickle analogy. You know, we're all cucumbers, and you drink or use so much, you turn into a pickle and you can't ever turn back. You know, I've always been this way. I was this way before I ever started using and drinking. So I want to read something on page 52. I'm sure you guys know what this is. We were having trouble with our personal relationships. We couldn't control our emotional natures. We were prey to misery and depression. We couldn't make a living. We had a feeling of uselessness. We were full of fear. We were unhappy. We couldn't seem to be of real help to other people. Those are the bedevilments, right? And that was me my whole life before this program. And what I found is in this program, the bedevilments have been replaced with all the promises. And, you know, let me get back to where I was. So I would have spree after spree after spree. And I left here taking all these pills. I was taking something for pain, something for sleep, you know, and then the sleep med made me gain like 50 pounds. And you know, I took something else for that. And then I got ED from the thing I was taking for pain, and took Viagra for that, you know, and there was just more and more insanity, right? Until I ever tried to be sober, I was never able to take vacations or anything. Well, I was lucky enough to take a vacation. We went to Florida, to Destin, and I was not right. I was uh, I was at that point, I hadn't been more crazy in my life, and my kids were out at the beach, and my wife was out at the beach, and I was back at the condo, and I looked in her purse, and at that moment, I started stealing her pills. And of course, when I did it, it was like, I have all this entitlement, all this, you know, all these reasons to convince myself that it was the right thing to do, and that it was okay. But you know, after then, I started beating myself up, and I hated myself even more. And what would happen to me is I would have spree after spree after spree after spree until I ended up in treatment again in 2017. This, like I said, it's a progressive disease. My sprees would get worse and worse and worse. And one of the toughest things about sobriety has been, you know, my nuclear family knows more about my blackouts than I do. You know, and it's at first you're like, damn, how do I do amends on that? You know, and there's a way for everything. Thank God. It'd be October 2016. My wife got T-boned in a really bad accident, not far from home. And, you know, I rush up to the accident scene like knight in shining armor. The accident was so bad, every airbag was deployed. And I couldn't even see her. They wouldn't let me walk up close enough to where I could even, you know, maybe peek at her between the airbags or whatever, you know. And I'm trying to start a fight with the guy that hit her, you know. And all of a sudden, I'm a trailer expert, and I'm a weight pulling expert or load hauling expert. And this guy's pulling way too much dirt without having a gooseneck hitch on his trailer, and hits my wife and just everything, you know. And I was just so bad in my disease, and I just sit there and watch her get cut out of the car, and I could hear her, you know, and I could hear her talking to them, and just the fact that I couldn't talk to her, you know, that was already freaking me out. And they cut her out and put her in the ambulance and told me to get all of her stuff out of the vehicle. And they made me ride in the front of the ambulance, and she rode in the back to the hospital. You know, I'm wearing my knight in shining armor, and you know, I'm looking down. Her purse is in my lap. What do? You know, I look down. I'm in her purse. You know, and she's at the hospital in her room. She's kind of like still the way I remember it. She's still on a stretcher, but they just put her on the gurney. They had cut her shirt off, her bra off. She was had a neck brace on. She was real vulnerable. It's the best word I can think of. And I looked down at her, and she looked up at me and saw me scratching my nose. She's like, "You're high, aren't you?" Like that. And I was like, "No." You know, and of course I tried to carry that lie and went to another spree, and I didn't remember anything for the next 3 days. So what would happen was I kept having sprees, right? And I tried to go to meetings. I'd sit in the meetings, and I was just, I didn't even know what I was doing. And in all this time, trying to be sober this first year, you know, I never got a sponsor. I had all these reasons why I wasn't going to ask people for rides. You know, my license was suspended. I wasn't going to, all these reasons why I wasn't going to get to meetings, you know, and, you know, all those reasons I found out were just flat out excuses. You know, because in sobriety now, I mean, anything's possible. You just have to want it bad enough. And that's one thing that I do when I look at people with, like, a lot of time. There's a lot of people in my home group. I've really got three home groups out in the Lakeway area. And there's a lot of people that I look up to. You know, and I was telling Kent on the way up here, you know, I don't ever try to put myself in a sphere of somebody that's got a lot of time. But you know what? I can still tell myself that today I want to be sober just as bad as they do. You know, and that's the key. I have to want to be sober today. So back in the problem, I had a few more sprees and around through the end of 2016 to 2017, and right before the last spree, my wife and I got in a fight. And, you know, we've always had a real good marriage. She's always been my best friend. We're soulmates. We've been together for 21 years. And we'd been together 21 years, and she wasn't someone that was going to leave me. It was always, you know, for better, for worse, although she was dealing with the worst most of the time, for better, for worse, or for richer or poorer, you know, thick and thin. And she wasn't ever going to leave me, but, you know, we got in a fight. She was like, you know what? And I was like, what? She said, when you're passed out on the floor, I just find myself wishing that you wouldn't wake up. You know, and, man, that really, really stuck. And, of course, I wasn't sober, so, and I wasn't in a program. So, you know, what did I do with that? I just went further down the rabbit hole. I could not get out of the hole because I couldn't put the shovel down. And I ended up having one last spree, and I wish I could say I'd had an out-of-body experience or, you know, some white light thing or something like that, but I woke up in Lakeway Hospital. I had OD'd. I ate a whole bottle of Norco, a whole bottle of Xanax, a whole bottle of Klonopin, a whole bottle of Adderall. At this point, in about a day and a half period, because once I black out, I had no, you know, I definitely didn't have the power of choice, right? During this time, while I'm stealing pills from my wife, you know, she starts getting a safe, and, you know, I find a way to get in a safe. You know, when we want what we want, we're pretty intelligent people, you know. And I'm like, in my mind, I'm like going, you know, hey, I'm not really good with this microphone. I'm really trying. What if she counts her pills and there she comes up short? You know, I was like, well, she can't blame it on me because they're in the safe, you know. And oh boy. Whenever I OD'd and when I came out of it, the doctor said that they lost me, that I shouldn't be there. That, like, I basically died, and they lost me, and somehow I came back, and I don't remember anything. I just remember darkness, just flat out darkness, and that also scared me too. And once I made a decision to go into treatment, so about a month later, I ended up going to Serenity House in Fredericksburg. And I saw pictures of the safe. I don't know what I tried to do with it. It looked like I tried to have sex with it. I mean, it was just completely torn apart. I was like, what the hell did I do? You know, my wife had to file a police report on me for stealing her meds so she could get her doctors to refill her meds. You know, and all this is, you know, deriving from, you know, there was a part of me that was always trying to make the people around me happy. Trying to keep my wife happy, my kids happy. You know, I can't keep anybody happy. And I didn't understand that then. And there's a fear that comes with that, right? And I decided to go ahead and go into treatment. And when I went to treatment, I was chemically sober, but I hadn't been more crazy in my life. I was abusing my non-narcotic meds. In this year and a half, 2 year period, I started to go see a psychiatrist, because when I started beating myself up from the first time I stole the pills, I told myself, you know what, I'm going to go see a shrink. That's the answer. You know, and he gave me some meds that helped me out. You know, I was taking something for PTSD, for insomnia, for depression, for, you know, all these isms. And I thought that was right, but I was abusing those too. And when I went through those periods of those DWIs, they ended up, the last one ended up to where I woke up in jail for like 2 weeks. I woke up in jail and was there for 2 weeks without knowing why I was there. And I spent a 9-month county sentence. And my job in jail was to fire watch the slick cell hall. I don't know if you guys know what the slick cells are. They're padded rooms and everything, and they strip you naked, and they put a rascal wrap on you so you can't hide anything. And I had to make sure that they were on 6-hour shifts, you know. And so I got to see people coming off of everything, heroin, coke, meth, everything. And, you know, if you ask me, by far the worst thing people coming off of is people taking a bunch of Xanax. It's horrible. Just the seizures and just flat out, just out of this world people are. You know, they're all bad. But what I'm getting at is I spent a 9-month county sentence watching people that basically I should have been looking at it, like I was looking in a mirror, you know, seeing what I looked like when I came in, because I was in jail for 2 weeks and didn't even know I was there. My case had gotten so complicated that they didn't even know how to charge me. They didn't want to stack all these DWIs on me, you know, because I'd been gone for a long time. And that's what they said. But anyway, I was trying to change, and I knew I wanted to change, you know, but I was doing it for all the wrong reasons. I was trying to change for my wife, for my kids, for my job, for everything. And, you know, it ended up getting me in rehab twice. When I got to rehab the second time at Serenity House in Fredericksburg, you know, I think every bottom that I had, I didn't want to realize how bad it was. And I was always dealing with the current bottom so it wouldn't be as bad as the previous bottom, you know, and it just doesn't work that way. And I had never been more crazy in my life. People talk about batshit crazy. I don't know. I'm on the Jim Carrey thing. So if you guys seen Me, Myself, and Irene, I was nutty as a squirrel turd. I mean, I was just and that's what it took, right? It took me being at that bottom. It took me getting to that point because up until this point, I hadn't cheated on my wife. I hadn't, you know, I'd always come home for my kids. I'd always had some little bit of respectability, I thought. And you know, that's the only thing that really kept me going, but it was, you know, get me further and further down the hole. None of that was enough. None of that was enough. I had to be at a point where I was just absolutely just sick and tired of being sick and tired. I know it's cliche, but it's freaking true. I had to do this for me. I don't know why, because I was clean. They made me go to detox in Abilene and then back to Fredericksburg. And they started taking us to the meetings that were off campus. And it was a meeting with a bunch of old timers, you know, and they're just sitting there on the table with their arms on the table and just looking straight across, you know, not happy, not sad, just grounded, you know. And I was like, you know what? They're my age when they made a turnaround, and this is exactly where I need to be. And up to that point, I couldn't figure out why in the hell I was there. I knew I needed to go, but I still didn't know why I was there. I can remember being in detox in Abilene and going, you know, hey, how did this happen again? You know, I'm not like these people, you know, how did this happen again? And so I made a conscious decision that I wanted what they had. And at that point I was willing to go to any length to get it. And I got a sponsor from that meeting that night. I started working the steps in treatment. And, thank God that my sponsor was an old timer. He's been sober since the 60s. And, you know, that's why I like to bring Kent. Because, you know, AA was founded for people to just come in off the street and get sober in the rooms. You know, and that's how Kent did it. Because Kent really wants this, you know. And he's been in surrender ever since the first time I met him. You know, his bottom was bad too. And, you know, but I had to go to treatment. My sponsor got me to do the steps like they were meant to do, you know, in a matter of days, not in a matter of weeks, months, or years, you know. And what happened was I did the steps in a matter of days, and it produced a spiritual experience. I had a place in the wilderness where I would go pray. Hey, Chris, what time? Okay. There was a place in the wilderness where I go pray out in the hills of Fredericksburg. And, you know, I can remember, you know, the writing was on the wall for me to lose a bunch of shit, my marriage, my house, my kids, everything. And I can remember telling God, you know what? I don't care about anything anymore. I don't care about the Christian I thought I was supposed to be. I didn't care about anything. I don't care what I know about you. I'm letting it all go. I don't care what I lose. And for the first time in my life, I was at a point where I wasn't scared to lose what I had. And I wasn't scared to not get what I wanted. And that's what it took for me to do this for me. And every single day since doing this one day at a time. Because, you know, I'll never be cured. All I have is a daily reprieve contingent on the maintenance of my spiritual condition. And I have to maintain this every day. I have to do this one day at a time. And when I had my spiritual awakening, I had done step three. And about 3 days later, you know, God's funny, right? He's like, okay, I'm going to see how serious you are. I got served divorce papers in treatment. I had already started on step four. The way I did step four was I just wrote shit down and closed it. Wrote shit down, closed it. And then once I got to the point where I was ready, you know, my sponsor helped me put them in columns and you know, and then I did step five. And he said, you know what, I'm going to see if you're really going to stick with this, you know. And it was crazy. I was like, you know what, the best way I can explain it is I was just so honed in on not being that way anymore. I didn't care where I was, who my friends were, what I looked like. I didn't care. I didn't care about anything worldly at that point. And I started doing step five. And the reason I read that freedom from bondage passage was because the next day I woke up, just all the fear was just gone. Just completely gone. For the first time in my life, I wasn't living under this big, heavy cloud of fear. I mean, you know, where I'm from and, you know, getting made fun of and not fitting in and stuff, you know, I believe that people have noticed my spiritual malady my whole life, and it's made people uncomfortable. And that's why I got made fun of. This world ridicules what it doesn't understand, right? And through step four and five, I was able to figure that out, and that was revealed to me, and I was able to let that go. You know, I don't hate the people where I'm from anymore, and, you know, that's another thing. But all the fear was just gone. That's the best way I can explain it. And now, don't get me wrong. Anyone who says they don't have fear is lying, or they're crazy, or they're definitely not sober. But this program's allowed me to put fear where it belongs. I fear myself, and I fear my disease. You know, and that helps me keep fear where it's supposed to be, and keeps it from getting in the way of my higher power. And I went ahead and did step four and five, and just the power of looking someone else in the eyes, I was like, man, what was I scared of? You know, things in the book started clicking for me. It says in the very beginning that God doesn't make too hard turns for those who seek him. I was like, okay, so what are you scared of? And that was the first time we agnostics started making sense to me. And just the fact of looking someone else in the eyes and have them tell you, you know, you're not the first person to tell me that. You're not the first person to tell me that. It's okay. You know, sometimes I get a little too honest, but, you know, I had a homosexual relationship when I was in the sixth grade, and I hated myself for it. I can remember sitting in class and looking at a new vein on my hand thinking, because back then it was like people got AIDS because they were being punished for being gay, and I'm not gay, but, you know, I hated myself for that, and I never told anybody about that stuff, you know, and no matter how chemically sober I would get, those things came back. And, you know, I was in a really bad hole. I brought my book because I know this isn't about doing a public step five, but, you know, I was when I did my sex inventory, I was responsible for a lot of abortions, you know, more than a few. And I was like, how do I make amends for that? You know, and my sponsor and I figured out a way, you know. And at the time I was raising my grandkids. I've got four grandkids, and that was a way, you know. And when I was in the middle of doing step nine, because I'll show you that in just a second. But we ended up doing 30 days in Fredericksburg, and then I went to Abilene and did 60 days sober living. And if you guys have the opportunity to do sober living, it was essential to my recovery. I did my 90-90, you know, and despite what anybody tells you, there's a lot of asshole complex in sobriety, but you know what? I learned to enjoy life. That's what I learned to do. And I learned to, I've always just liked to make people smile without wanting anything in return. That's just me. But before my disease, you know, I'd make a agreement in my head with somebody. Well, if they don't smile back, you know, well, fuck them, you know, piss on them, you know, and, you know, I was living with the resentment there. So, like I said, I did the steps, and I did the steps really quickly, not quickly, but I did it in a matter of days, and, you know, it produced that spiritual experience for me. And the only step that I couldn't do till I got back home was step 9. But, you know, step 8 was already done if I did a complete and thorough step 4. And when I'm home doing my amends and everything and living in amends, because I had to learn what the living amends was before I ever came home. And I'll be living a living amends for the rest of my life. And, you know, I was doing this amend for these abortions, you know, that I was like, man, how do I ever get out of that, you know? And this lady came up in the parking lot at HEB and just handed me this picture with a smile and gave me a big hug. And I was like, wow. You know, and before that, I ran into an old boss that I'd screwed over when I went to jail at the mall when I was Christmas shopping for someone else other than myself. And I ran into an old boss inside the Apple store that I would probably would otherwise have never seen again. What I'm saying is doing this program, as long as you're willing to make that amends whenever it comes, you know, there's a way and they'll happen, you know, they really will. And, you know, still to this day, I used to keep my vodka on the shelf above my washing machine because I do the laundry at home. And the smell of laundry detergent makes my brain think of vodka. You know, so what do? I went and got the same washing machine that I had in sober living. You know, there's just a solution for everything, you know. And I'm more happy and healthier. When I had my psychic change and all the fear was gone, you know, all these crazy things happen. I you know, they have the smoking cessation signs here at Austin Recovery. If I hadn't seen those, I wouldn't have. I used to chew tobacco, smoke, you know, eat late, everything. All that stopped, man, all at once. Once I decided I didn't want to be a slave to anything anymore, then it was I could let it go. So if you think you can do it, I recommend quit everything while you're in rehab. You know, I couldn't have done it any other way than the way I did it. And I stopped eating past 5:30. I got healthy, lost a bunch of weight. And you know, life has just been truly good. I've been taking vacations. My marriage did end up working out. I usually don't get to that, because I don't want it to be about that. I didn't do it for that. And that's the only reason it did work out. Is because I stay sober for me and I worry about my side of the street and I stay sober for me. I don't stay sober for anyone else. Because as soon as I do, you know, I'm out of the program, you know, you guys know how that's going to end up. So, you know, step 12, I want to get to real quick. Actually, step 11, I started doing that when I was in treatment. I told my sponsor I was going to start doing that. She's like, yeah, why don't you start sharing that at meetings? I was like, yeah. So I started doing step 11 before I went through all the steps. Then step 12, you hear about, you know, most of the time you get carrying the message, but practicing these principles in all our affairs, you know, I went scuba diving for crying out loud a year ago and, you know, I'm down 60 feet. And that's a lot of pressure for the first time doing it, you know, and I spent all this time deep pressurizing going all the way down and then my mask starts leaking and the Caribbean is really, really salty. So my face is on fire and I start freaking out and my disease wants to just jump right behind the wheel again. You know, I was like, okay, hang on. I can't just swim to the top right now because I'll die. I'm not in control. Step one, I'm powerless. Powerless over people, places, and things. Just breathe. They got the tour guide came and helped me fix my mask. And then when I got done and I was taking off all the equipment, I was like, man, I just used the program to freaking scuba dive. You know? It's just really been a way of life for me. So, you know, if I'm standing here, this program works. That's all I can say. There's no other way to say it. And I could have just made this a lot shorter and not said anything and went, just do the 12 steps. You know, how bad do you want to be sober? You know, suit up. What is it? Suit up, show up, sit down, shut up. You know, I never really did take well to that. But it's really nice being here, guys. Thanks for letting me be here. It's really a new level of serenity when I get to come to the treatment centers. and be here with you guys, and especially see. Love you, man. Yeah.